I'm very pleased with all with the papers. You know, there's here and there some ragged edges, but you're all, I think, grappling with these issues in a really serious and thoughtful way. As I think I may have mentioned, when all of you become professors at some point in the future, or at least some of you, you'll have this combination of dread and anticipation when you have a stack of papers to read. So the anticipation is that there'll be some that'll be really interesting, sometimes even playfully interesting, and you'll really have fun engaging in conversation, and others where you just have to buckle down and figure out how to make sense of whatever is written. And the ratio between those two is a key indicator of the nature of a class. And we got a really good ratio in this class. I really did enjoy. So I'm looking forward to the third papers without much dread, just with anticipation. I'd like to share just a little bit of actually the conversation that we just had with Yang Fei in office hours, because it bears very heavily on some of the things we'll be talking about, including today. But actually, some issues came up that aren't very centrally in my lectures on this material, and should be. You know, it's a nice thing when you have an unstructured conversation, then themes come up that really should be in the way. So I learned from our collective, our little discussion. So here was the issue, was to kind of make sense of nationalism and religion. This is how it sort of came up. The initial question had to do with how in China you can have a party which still uses communist ideology and the economy is so completely disjoint from that. And how can people put these two things together? And so the first thing I said is, well, most people just don't worry about having all sorts of inconsistent beliefs. It's just sort of standard human cognition is to hold beliefs that don't fit together, but then to have little bridges that make them work. So in the, you know, in the American context, people broadly do believe that that poverty is a problem and that poor people's lives, and that it's a collective problem, that it would be better if poverty was reduced. And a lot of people believe that taxes should be cut on the rich. And that seems completely discordant. Well, you have this bridging belief trickle down. And that's how tax cuts on the rich are defended. Tax cuts on the rich are not defended on the grounds that the rich need to be richer because that makes their lives go better. Nobody says that. A few people say the rich should be richer because it's unjust to take anything from anybody, but that's really not the core of the defense. The core of the defense is not the hardcore libertarian defense that taxation is theft and that it's simply immoral to tax the rich. Almost nobody says that. Certainly no politicians say that. What they say is, reduce taxing on the rich, that will make the economy grow and it will help the poor. So that bridging belief is key to reconciling these otherwise disparate ideas. And then, so our conversation meandered nicely along, and then another kind of issue came up, which is the fact that if you did a survey and people answered it correct, you know, honestly, in China, about their views of the elite, you'd have a huge proportion of the population saying they're corrupt. You know, very little sympathy for their lifestyles, for a belief that they really have the interests of the people at heart, that they're doing all these corrupt things. On the other hand, when the same leaders announce indignation about the Japanese encroachment on these little islands between China and Japan, and denounce the Taiwanese for considering themselves not part of China, nationally people will say, yeah, right on, you know, China is the greatest country in the world. When the leaders announce that the 21st century is the Chinese century and that we're destined to cover our after 300 years or 400 years of decline because of the rise of the West, now we will be the dominant power in the world, and they hold all these symbols that people buy into it, even though they also regard those same leaders as corrupt. Well, that's kind of weird that you sort of buy into this nationalistic stuff while simultaneously holding the belief that the actual people are not to be trusted. And that, I think, reflects some very particular aspects of ideology around both nationalism and religion. These seem to be the kinds of belief systems which are most amenable to this particular phenomenon. There are others, I'm sure. And that's the way in which both nationalism and religion combine a set of beliefs about how the world works. So there's real cognitive elements, so beliefs in the sense we've been talking about them. Answers to the questions what exists, what is good, and what is possible in both nationalism and religion. But what nationalism and religion do also is powerfully connect those beliefs to clusters of emotions. And you know, one simple way of thinking about it is both religion and nationalism combine powerful emotions of involving belief, involving love and hate, the two together. Nationalism, most notably, strong nationalist beliefs always have a negative emotions about some category of other, and powerful, warm, encompassing emotions, which we associate, you know, you can broadly call it love, connectedness, deep purpose of valuing. Combining those two, and that's partially what makes both nationalism and religion such dangerous kinds of beliefs. They also, both of them, historically, get that emotional power from their connection to charismatic leaders. So charismatic leaders are people who have particular skills, particular ways of particularly speaking, in which they can directly tap into this emotional life of people and connect it to the beliefs in question. That charismatic leaders are often felt to have a divine spark. They have this quality of being able to convince you of the truth of their beliefs because they disable, I think, your rational critical capacities through this combination of love and hate. There's often this combination of rageful speaking. You know, there's anger in their speaking style, while also affirming the righteousness and the commonality and the solidarity of some category of people, which leads both religion and nationalism to be belief systems that also fuel murderous aggression against the despised others. So the point about this is the key problem of how emotions get anchored, how beliefs get anchored in emotions, and really consolidated in particular ways by virtue of that connection. That's not a theme which I was planning on talking about. And it's clearly a real important aspect of why, of how ideologies work. It also strikes me as a kind of tragic aspect of the problem of those people like myself, and I assume many of you, who are kind of children of the Enlightenment, and who believe in rationality, believe in good argument, who believe in a sense in the kind of calm and cold assessment of the accuracy of different beliefs, and who find it very uncomfortable to try to convince people of the desirability of certain beliefs by mobilizing their emotions. And it, in a sense, it creates an asymmetry between the left and the right, certainly in the contemporary context. You know, there of course have been historical moments when the left has attempted to mobilize emotions in that way, often when it connects the leftist project with nationalism, though. I mean, that's really the third world liberation struggles that involved Marxist ideas and communist ideas. A lot of it got their power from its connection with anti-colonialism and nationalism. Certainly true in China, certainly true in Vietnam. Probably less true in Cuba initially, I think, from what I understand. But still, it's a general phenomenon. So, I mean, as a leftist, I'm at a disadvantage when I am engaged in debate with the right, so to speak, because the right's perfectly prepared to mobilize all sorts of emotional symbols, to play on fear, to mobilize hatred. I find it really hard to even mobilize hatred against the hateful forces in the world. I mean, I don't want, in my discussions of what's wrong with capitalism, to focus on kind of the nefarious, disgusting, despicable character of capitalists. You know, it's not that I don't think there's all sorts of bad actors that should be criticized, but to have as the strategy for convincing people about the wrongness of the system, mobilizing disgust, which is a very powerful, another negative emotion, you know, I'm very uncomfortable doing all that. And that's, in a sense, you're fighting then a battle, an ideological battle, on unequal terms. And we see this in political campaigns. It's, you know, both progressives and conservatives, when they do their campaign ads, simplify things. But outright lies in an ad, simply saying untruths about your opponent, is way more characteristic on the right than even in the American context. The liberal left isn't all that left, but still, there's more of a commitment to truth-telling and not to this venal manipulation of emotions connected to falsehoods. Unfortunately, emotions work. We know it's effective. Well, okay. That's a dimension of this stuff on ideology, is how the cognitive aspects, which is what I'm emphasizing, get their power because of the way they get bonded, connected to emotional aspects. Today, our topic, hegemony and legitimation. And as you'll see, there's a bunch of, if we have time, there's some graphs from some writing that I've done on gender, which I think are pretty relevant to our discussion and around the transformation of norms. Gender is, I think, an extremely fertile context for looking at transformation of people's views about what exists, what is good, and what is possible. Because the answers to those questions 50 years ago were way, way different than they are today, in ways that really do matter. And the question is, how do we understand the process by which the legitimation and normative moral aspects of ideologies, how do we understand the process by which it changes? And in particular, can we think of strategic aspects of the way it changes? That is, can we engage in practices which speed certain kinds of normative change, or are they simply the byproducts of changes that are going on in a diffused and micro way in which we can't really do much strategically? Well, I think gender is a nice context for thinking about that. We'll, at the end of the lecture today, explore that. But let's begin with this really interesting idea, hegemony, and exactly what it means. Sometimes hegemony is just sort of meant to be ideological domination with a capital D. You know, so you got ideology, got ideological domination, and then you got hegemony, that sort of domination with whoomph. Right? I think it's more useful to treat the notion of a hegemonic ideology or ideological hegemony, to use this term hegemony, in a narrower way, to see it not as the universal condition for powerful ideologies, but as a particular way that ideologies become powerful and stabilized. And to use hegemony then in general as a counterpoint to sheer domination. Now, it doesn't mean, this is a bit like the distinction I made in the class, the discussion of class between exploitation and oppression. It doesn't mean that exploitation isn't itself a form of oppression. Hegemonic ideologies is a form of a dominant ideology. So it's not that hegemonic ideologies aren't dominant any more than exploitation isn't oppressive. But not all dominant ideologies have this strongly hegemonic character. And so trying to really identify what this word, what gives it specificity, I think is important. The term, I don't know if it literally originated with Gramsci, the Italian Marxist theorist, or as the Brits call it, Gramsci. So if you hear a Brit lecturing, it'll suddenly be about Gramsci, not Gramsci. Does anybody speak Italian here to know whether, how the Italian, because we should do it in the Italian way. I just always learned it as Gramsci. Would it be Gramsci? It'd be Gramsci. So the Brits are just being there. It's like, when I studied at Oxford, I had a British historian, a fantastic historian of French history, completely bilingual in French. I mean, you know, but he insisted on calling Marseille, Marseilles. And Lyon, Lyons. Because that's the way it's pronounced in Britain. Now, it's true that we all call Paris, Paris, not Paris. That's what when I said, why do you call it Marseilles? And he said, well, why do you call it Paris? And everybody calls Florence, Florence, not Firenze. And so it's a kind of interesting linguistic thing why, you know, you anglicize some places, place names and names and not others. Well, I never got used to Don Quixote being called Don Quixote, which is also the way in Britain. This may have softened in the last few decades, but it used to be there. Particularly erudite Brits, you know, people teaching at Oxford and Cambridge were very insistent on using the English form of those words, and they considered it an affectation to say Don Quixote. It really is just Don Quixote. Okay, Gramsci, not Gramsci. He introduced this idea. And he was using this as a way of distinguishing the nature of the class systems and the nature of class rule in the most stable and robust countries of the West compared to the more fragile, as he saw it, social orders of Eastern Europe and then places like Italy, where it was under question the extent to which the class system and its systems of rule would become hegemonic or remain just dominant. And he identified that the term he used to kind of capture this was he described, hegemony describes the capacity of a class for moral and intellectual leadership. Now, Gramsci himself is notoriously opaque. He was writing in prison. These writings come from what are called the prison notebooks. It's quite a remarkable feature of Italian fascism that Gramsci could have written his most important theoretical works that have become the anchor points for late 20th century, a certain strand of late 20th century social theory, that he could have written it while in prison. You know, that doesn't correspond to how we think of fascism. As far as I know, there were no important theoretical texts written in Stalinist prison camps, or in Germany, in the Nazi prisons. Italian fascism really was different in this respect, and Gramsci was able to write these important texts. So the key issue here is, what's really implied by this idea of leadership? moral and intellectual leadership. So let me begin by talking a little bit about what we mean by a leader, what's involved in that idea, and then talk about what it means to have moral and intellectual leadership. And on the latter, I'm going to particularly draw on this wonderful paper by Chantal Mouffe, which was the core assigned reading, which I think she's nailed it. I think she's got this idea right. She's figured it out better than other people. Okay, so first, leadership. Here's the way I like to think of it. I think of a distinction between a leader and a boss. So both leaders and bosses give instructions, tell you what to do, but you follow those instructions for different reasons. A boss tells you what to do. A leader induces you to do things by virtue of the assurances you have that the leader has your interests at heart. That when the leader tells you to do something, you trust the leader. That the leader is not just telling you to do it because it's good for the leader, although it may also be good for the leader, but that the leader is seriously taking into account what's good for you. So if you have confidence in the leader, even if you don't quite understand the instruction, you're not sure why this is happening, maybe the circumstances don't allow full explanation, you say, yes, I trust this leader. They're looking out for me. They're not just telling me to do things because it's what's going to be good for them, regardless of its cost for me. A boss tells you to do something, you do it, but not because of any belief that the boss is really concerned about your welfare, but because there are consequences for disobedience. For the boss, the issue is you make a calculation as to the costs and benefits of following the instruction, and since bosses typically have sanctions available, depending upon the context, you do it because it's not worth resisting. It's too costly. That's not why you follow leaders. Even though leaders may also have sanctions available. Leader may have, you may get kicked out of the group, for example, if you don't do what you're told. But that isn't the reason why you're doing what you're told. Leadership implies, when we're speaking then of a class, and the ruling class, to say the ruling class has leadership capacity implies that it has an ability to give direction to social development, to establish a project of the ruling class as the universal project for everyone, in which the interests of subordinate classes are at least taken seriously and somehow or other accommodated in that project. So a ruling class is hegemonic when it is the case that the project it sets, that it's guiding, that it's ruling, which is in its interests, also accommodates the interests of subordinate classes. Now, we can discuss whether it's just that people have to believe that that's the case or whether it actually has to be the case. Shavorsky argues basically that to be a durable hegemonic class, the ruling class has to actually accommodate the interests of the subordinate classes. It can't just forever claim to do so and for people to believe it. That the belief that the ruling class is a leading class, that belief requires some material payoff. When there's a famous quote from the CEO of General Motors, what's good for GM is good for America. That's the self-confident statement of a titan of industry who is acting as a hegemonic class. And note that what's good for GM is good for America, it's not complete baloney. You know, that statement, of course, taken too literally and too narrowly, has a lot of bullshit in it. But there is some core truth to the matter. It's certainly the case that what's bad for GM isn't good for America. It's not good for American workers for GM to go bankrupt. So long as the system is capitalist, better for workers if GM is a thriving and profitable firm than if it's a feeble and decrepit firm. What's good, and it's true also that as a symbol, what's good for GM is good for America, is more broadly what's good for the capitalist corporations are good for America. Now, when that actually does reflect the way in which the interests of subordinate classes are not only dependent upon the success of dominant classes, but are actually advanced by, you know, this more positive sense, then you can really talk about a class being hegemonic, not just dominant. Michael Burovoy makes a nice distinction in his analysis of the labor process between two different ways in which within factories, the what he calls the regime of the factory can be organized. And he distinguishes, the terms he uses are, is the despotic despotic regime and a hegemonic regime. A despotic organization of work is one in which workers work because of the sanctions they face. A hegemonic regime of work is where workers work hard because, at least to some extent, they're getting something out of working hard. Their interests are advanced as well as the firm's by them working. So shirking in the first case, in a despotic regime, shirking is blocked by fear. Whereas in the second case, shirking is blocked by workers monitoring each other and imposing normative constraints. So we can say that workers work hard in the second case, under a hegemonic case, at least in part because they are of consent. There are some classic little slogans that reflect that. A fair day's work for a fair day's pay. Now that's a powerful working class moral stand. I'm a worker, I'll give you a fair day's work if you give me a fair day's pay. That's putting a moral obligation on the employer, right? It's saying, look, you treat me well, I'll be responsible back. A hegemonic regime is one in which the employer respects that norm as well. The employer doesn't ask, how can I pay these workers as little as possible? The employer says, okay, what, given all things considered, is a fair day's pay? That insight that there's a distinction between a despotic and a hegemonic regime of capitalist production, and it's variable, it's not really a binary, you know, there's many corporations in which some of the workers are operating under a hegemonic regime and others under a despotic regime. Japan notoriously had a dual labor market structure inside of firms where there was a significant segment of the firm that was unquestionably hegemonic. They had lifetime contracts. It was almost impossible to fire them. They really did believe in a fair day's work for a fair day's pay, and they were treated well. And then you had contingent workers who could be fired at will, who had no secure contracts, and whose were operating much more under a hegemonic regime, a despotic regime, with the added kind of twist that whereas individuals would be in one or the other of these segments, households tended to combine the two. It's a key point, because it meant that even in the despotic part of the factory, they were connected to the hegemonic part through the household. Made for a very stable class structure with respect to the process, labor process. You know, so if households always have this hegemonic connection to the hegemonic process, and people in the despotic part are still benefiting from the hegemonic deal, well, it makes it less despotic, really. That is, the experience of their situation is less despotic by virtue of, you know, what we've called mediated class locations. Okay, that's the basic idea of leadership. Now let's look at this at an ideological level. This, did you have a question? You were sort of half raising your.
No, I mean, I would also add that in the Japanese case, the union was actually, the head of the union was almost always invariably high level managers.
Yeah.
So even the, like, I guess the basic mechanism whereby workers interact with management was mediated through the higher levels of leadership of the company.
Yeah.
So you didn't have anything akin to what the U.S. does, where the two were actually combative on some level.
Right, there was,
yeah,
what's called company unions, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
It's also the case that in Japan, most managers are recruited up from shop floor. At least they have to spend some time on the shop floor before they become managers.
Yeah.
If so, the word recruit isn't so appropriate always. It's more the early stage of a managerial career is side by side on the shop floor, which also creates a more organic connection between workers and managers. And one should say it creates more a more empathic understanding of the condition of work for managers. So it's not all just smoke and mirrors. There is actually greater forms of mutual obligation created by those that structure of relations than is created when they're more fully bifurcated. Okay, let's look at moral and intellectual leadership. So now we're going to take this general idea of leadership and see what does it mean when we're talking about the ideas that people hold. That's the intellectual, moral and intellectual leadership. I'm identifying the moral part with the component of ideology, what is good. You know, that's the what is good question is the one that invokes moral issues. And the what exists and what is possible is the bits that are connected to the intellectual leadership. This is really a package, though. We don't need to, for these purposes, make that particular distinction. So what MOVE does is draws a distinction between two different ways of thinking about having an oppositional ideology, of opposing the dominant ideological system. Two different ways of thinking of what opposition means or antagonism means at the level of ideology. The first way of thinking about this is that two contending ideologies can be seen as antagonistic in terms of every element within them, that you have a proletarian ideology, which is a negation, point by point, of a bourgeois ideology. This imagines ideological struggle as the confrontation of two paradigmatic ideologies. That expression, paradigmatic ideology, means that ideologies are paradigms, completely self-contained. They're closed systems of thought. And that to attack a paradigmatic ideology is to reject it in total. So that you have in the, to use the class language, bourgeois ideology and proletarian ideology, or capitalist ideology and socialist ideologies, you know, it depends upon how you want to label these, but they are confrontations of two idea systems that clash, and the way to think about the conflict is you have to destroy the other and replace it. This is using a model, a way of thinking about ideological antagonism that's similar to the way we think of, for example, the Copernican revolution in astronomy replacing the Ptolemaic system of astronomy. It's not that there are bits and pieces of the Ptolemaic system that are retained inside of Copernican, rather. It's a complete destruction of the previous ideology. Or Darwinian evolution versus biblical evolution, creationism. Darwinian evolution and creationism are two paradigmatically opposing ideologies of nature. And the previously dominant one, the biblical view of evolution, is destroyed when it is replaced by the Darwinian one. It's not that you retain it and then just add the Darwinian to it. That's what the idea of paradigmatically opposing ideologies are. Yeah?
When it comes to like the proletariat versus the bourgeoisie, I think it makes sense to think of like the proletarian ideology as wanting to destroy bourgeois ideology and like transition to a different system, but what about like the bourgeois ideology destroying proletarian ideology? Like, the bourgeoisie has to rely on the working class.
Well, they argue that even for the, it's not the right way to think of even the victory of the proletarian ideology. So let me give you the contrast. So the contrast is to imagine, to think of ideologies as having substantially the same set of elements, but they get organized into different matrices. So think of an ideology as a matrix that connects different ideological components. The form of that connection, Mouffe uses the term articulation, the articulation of elements within a matrix. You know, that's the particular jargon she uses. I think it's pretty transparent jargon once you get used to it. It's not, you know, impenetrable. Thus, for example, the belief of individual freedom is an element of both bourgeois and proletarian ideology. But the idea of freedom gets its meaning in the two different ideologies because of its connection to different other elements. In bourgeois ideology, freedom gets its content in part from its connection to private property as another element of ideology, whereas in proletarian ideology, it gets its content from its connection to collective self-determination. Two different elements in the ideology, in the two ideologies, which anchor the notion of freedom. Now, collective self-determination does appear in bourgeois ideology as well. The notion of democracy, which is a component of bourgeois ideology also, has an interface with the notion of collective self-determination. That term isn't used, but the idea of democracy is that people should collectively determine their fates. The kind of republican ideal of democracy, which is part of bourgeois ideology, is about sovereignty, self-determination of the polity. But it isn't the anchor for the idea of individual freedom. The anchor for the idea of individual freedom comes from the connection of individual freedom to private property. One can even argue, although it's not typically emphasized, although sometimes it gets talked about, that in a proletarian or socialist ideology, there remains an idea of private property. Because most socialist ideologies are not advocating the kibbutz, you know, where everybody gets their clothing from a common dispensary and returns it to a laundry and nobody owns anything. So the kibbutz is this very radical communitarian ideal where nobody owns anything. Everything is owned collectively. Well, most socialists don't, and most revolutionaries have not advocated the complete abolition of personal property. It's just that it's very restricted. The domain of the private property is restricted to personal property, but it still has a component, but it's not the anchor of freedom, for sure. Okay, so you've got these different elements, and what she then says is, ideological struggle is over the appropriation and reappropriation of elements into different matrices. So you can think of ideological struggle as a struggle on the terrain of ideology rather than between paradigmatic ideologies. It's struggle over the articulation and rearticulation, the severing of some connections and the strengthening of others. The idea of moral and intellectual leadership, Mouffe argues, is connected to the second sense of what ideological struggle amounts to. Hegemony that involves moral and intellectual leadership implies that many elements of popular struggles, ideological elements of popular struggles and demands, get incorporated into the ruling ideology. And the ruling ideology becomes hegemonic when it successfully articulates elements of ideas and beliefs that come from the masses, that come from popular struggles, when it successfully inserts them into the dominant configuration. When it successfully inserts them into the dominant configuration, that configuration becomes hegemonic. To the extent that the bourgeoisie is able to define the form of ideological struggle this way, it secures to a much greater extent its ideological dominance in the form of leadership over the population as a whole. in the history of struggles, ideological struggles, I think the most notable instance of this incorporation is the idea of democracy. I mean, the idea of democracy is fundamentally an anti-capitalist idea, an anti-ruling class idea. It was never an idea that came from the dominant classes. It was an idea born of struggles against dominant classes. The demands for democracy were a demands for a transformation of the fundamental power relations around the state and the society. When Marx was writing in the middle of the 19th century, he thought that democracy was this deeply incompatible element and that it was a kind of foundational threat to the bourgeoisie, not easily accommodated. And certainly, ruling class ideologies were anti-democratic. Eventually, democracy became incorporated into the rhetoric of and the ideological configuration of ruling class ideologies. The U.S. was probably the context where that ideological element got its strongest affirmation, and then it was copied elsewhere because of the success here. In the British in gradual drift towards democracy over a couple of centuries, the word democracy was never a very resonant term in the elites. I mean, now it is. Now they talk about British democracy, but that wasn't the way it was done, whereas in the United States, democracy early on was seen as a value, and then the question was the struggle for its full realization. The successful incorporation of democracy into bourgeois ideology is quite remarkable. You know, it's because it is such an incompatible element. The distinctively moral element of ideological hegemony has to do with incorporating popular moral elements into a hegemonic ideology, not just the ontological elements, the answers to the question what exists and what is possible. Let's just do a little example. This is under 2.3. This will help explain it. So this is an initial list, I think, of elements that you'd find in any pro-capitalist bourgeois ideology. You know, some of them may be foregrounded or backgrounded, but in one way or another, you'll get an ideological element of freedom, democracy, private property, equality, prosperity, material well-being. You can think of others, I'm sure. But these five are pretty central. You could add efficiency if you wanted to. That's another one that's another component. But let's look at these five. So then the question is, how are these articulated in a bourgeois ideology? And how are they articulated in a socialist ideology? And you could draw a little diagram. You know, you could put these five elements and you could draw connections between them and then label the connection. You know, explain how they're connected. And then you could see the struggle between bourgeois and proletarian ideologies, between pro-capitalist and pro-socialist ideologies, as struggles over either the severing of some connections or their replacement with another kind of connector, which gives it a different kind of meaning. So, I mean, I have a particular way of thinking about this. Maybe this might be a nice point to just open this up and just have people throw out. What do you think? Freedom, democracy, private property, equality, and material well-being. So what we want to do is let's think through the bourgeois connections. How would we think about it? And then let's sever them, transform them. So what do you think are the bourgeois connections among some of these? We don't have to do we could on the whiteboard, you know, have them all five and do a kind of comprehensive map of all the connections. I think that's probably more than we need to do now. It's not a bad exercise to do, you know, to be perfectly reasonable. Third paper, if some of you wanted to take this. You could do the same thing for gender, you know. What are the elements of gendered ideology? Any ideological space. And then think through what the articulations are under one versus another, but let's do it for these. Okay, yeah.
So, I don't know, like, material well-being is probably tied to freedom in the bourgeois ideology, but if it's tied to freedom in the socialist ideology, it's probably also tied to equality. You know, prosperity has to be spread a little bit. I mean, not it's just spread. The prosperity can't just be, like, certain people, so it seems like a choice to get prosper.
So, there's a connection between equality and prosperity in a socialist ideology that is not present. That particular connection is not present in a bourgeois ideology. So I think that's a plausible account of it. Yeah?
Oh, I think in bourgeois ideology, there is a very strong connection between freedom and private property. It's not necessarily there or definitely not as strong in socialist ideology.
So let's. What other connections are there with involving private property?
Material well-being.
Okay, so material well-being is derived from private property. So private property anchors the idea causally. There's a causal connection. So some of these will be moral connections. Some of them will be causal connections. Some of them may be some other kind of connection. So we could say in bourgeois ideology, one might even want to say private property plus freedom generates material well-being. So you could have a little propositional statement about that articulation. And that's almost a description of capitalism, right? Private property plus freedom leads to prosperity. Ah, that's capitalism. Yeah.
In bourgeois ideology, there seems to be this, doesn't really totally make sense, but there's a connection between freedom and equality. The idea is that freedom will generate equality. You know, if you let everyone do their own thing, if everyone has the freedom to do their own thing, equality will happen. But, that isn't a part of socialist ideology.
So the freedom-equality thing, I think, is an interesting couplet, freedom and equality. And I think it's a couplet that's involved in both ideologies. But it's a couplet that has quite different meanings, partially because of the way in which if you place equality at the center, the meaning of freedom changes. So it's actually the simple word freedom hides some separate concepts. Sometimes in philosophy, they refer to positive and negative freedom. You may have heard that expression. So it may be that in bourgeois ideology, it's just negative freedom that's being talked about. And equality then means equality before the law, which gives everybody the same negative freedom. Whereas in socialist ideology, equality means positive freedom, and it's equality, freedom means positive freedom, and the equality in question is the equality of material conditions of life that enable you to have positive freedom. So that's a pretty subtle kind of connection, right? Because the meanings of the terms begin to change as you explore how the connection goes. Yeah?
In bourgeois ideology, I guess, democracy can be seen as like political democracy, and so it's more so, I think, tied to private property and freedom in that sort of way, whereas in socialist ideology, we're talking about political and economic democracy, and so it's more tied to like equality and material well-being.
So the democracy one is certainly an absolutely key, and you know, over the years as I've thought about these things, I've gradually come to the realization that it's really democracy, even more than equality, which is the anchor for the whole articulation in socialism, or it ought to be, so that there's a tension. Some socialists anchor the whole edifice around equality, and others anchor the whole edifice around democracy. Of course, they're both connected. I've increasingly come to believe, you know, tentatively perhaps, that it actually makes more sense to see democracy as the real anchor, and that deepening and extending and making robust democracy is the element that has to be strengthened, which then transforms the meaning of these other elements. Rather than seeing equality as the real anchor. So in a certain moral sense, equality may be the anchor. But in an from this what is good articulation, you know, that part. Probably equality is, because the equal flourishing idea is really what drives one's aspirations. But the equal power idea, which is the democracy one, is what drives the institutional design. You know, so you can see how if you begin to really think about these articulations, it actually helps to sort out different elements. Other thoughts about, we haven't looked at all these connections, but yeah, Lauren.
The bourgeois ideology of democracy needs to be kept from interfering with private property in order to generate material well-being and negative freedom.
Right, absolutely. So that's a really good way, I think, of anchoring the contrast. So we can strip it down. In bourgeois ideology, private property imposes limits on democracy. In socialist ideology, democracy imposes limits on private property. Flip the arrow. A hell of a lot of action comes from flipping that arrow. So in bourgeois ideology, private property is pre-political. It's seen as a natural right. It's something which the state has to ratify and enforce, but the state doesn't create. Private property does figure in any sensible socialism. I mean, I think that the idea that there is absolutely no privacy around stuff seems both unnecessary and undesirable, but it should be the boundaries of it, its scope of action, where it's allowed, where it's not, how it's infringed upon, how it's not. That's not pre-political. It's determined by the democratic will of the people. So democracy puts limits on private property rather than private property puts limits on democracy. One might even argue, and if you really want to give the kind of stripped down account of the whole shebang, that once you flip that arrow, then the other articulations, they don't exactly fall in place, but it's the one that really drives much of the rest of the articulation. Well, we're engaged in a Mufian discussion of the articulation and rearticulation of ideology. If we were engaged in political fights, this would mean that as comrades discussing how do we organize our propaganda pamphlet, we have a really hard task. We can't just say reject everything in bourgeois ideology. We have to say, no, there's a lot of value in this ideology. It's just been distorted by its articulations. That's a harder kind of ideological battle to fight. Getting back to our earlier discussion about emotion and symbol, this requires a much cooler cognitive process as opposed to a hot one. Elster draws the distinction, which we'll discuss a little bit on Thursday, between hot and cold ideologies. He's basically meaning, or hot and cold cognition, I think. Hot cognition is cognition fueled by emotion, and cold cognition is fueled by argument. This is much more of the, let's carefully pick apart things, let's be precise in our discussion. It tends to make a more complex kind of exposition. Yeah.
It also can be. It seems like it can be really effective because people have a lot of common ground. Like in American society, class American right. society, there's these core values which students can all really identify with. But then you rearticulate
Absolutely.
It for how democracy is limited by capitalism. Then all of a sudden these lights turn on.
Absolutely. This is the whole dynamic involved here. It, absolutely, what's valuable about the rearticulation motion is that you make the oppositional ideology not strange. It corresponds to a lot of common sense, and then you show how people have been misunderstanding their own beliefs. So this rearticulation does have common ground. It then, however, does less comfortably fit into the us against them. The Battle of Titans, the kind of warfare image of what class struggle is about, including at the ideological level. Yeah?
It just seems like seems like it, this, we're so constrained by language in these configurations, because you have two entirely different, or two, both sides are using the same tools to try to talk about different things. So democracy can be taken up in one camp and mean one thing, and impose on an entirely different definition of democracy than a socialist ideology, which uses the same word, but invokes an entirely different matrix.
So what's argued here is that it's not entirely different.
It's
that there is some kernel of meaning in democracy which is shared, and then by virtue of its articulation gets,
it can be, but it's sort of it's a shifting signifier.
Right. But it is important that this does argue that there is genuine overlap, and then the articulation is what creates the action. And I think, you know, as Lauren pointed out, Lauren's been teaching with the American Society book, and it's not an accident that the book was written with this way of thinking about it, but it does, in the context of a class where you are engaged in the cold, not the hot, kind of thinking, you want people to have reasoned discussion and think through ideas, it's pretty effective in terms of getting people to recognize that there is a radical intuition underlying their own complacent acceptance of existing ideas. Yeah?
So then would you say that it's like pretty essential to figure out what it is that like the left and the right have in common when they talk about democracy in order to like effectively use democracy on the left or on the right?
I think it's important for the left, when it's trying to debate with you know, elites that don't give a shit. You know, they're using their own these ideas in purely instrumental ways for their own advance. But when you're talking to ordinary people who are sympathetic to the Tea Party, a lot of people who will be sympathetic to the Tea Party are sympathetic for reasons that connect to why the left is opposed to corporations. And you need to bring out, and that's essentially this articulation issue. And often, I mean, the irony here in a way is it's often the leftist articulation, which is the more common sense one, that actually corresponds to people's quiet intuitions. So when people are asked about freedom, their kind of quiet intuition is to be able to put their life plans into effect without asking permission, you know, that they can autonomously choose the kind of life they want to live. That's what people think about being free. And then when you point out, well, under inegalitarian conditions where some people have resources and other people don't, some people are more free than others because they can't put their, oh yeah, you know, people begin to understand that a certain view of equality is implied by their heartfelt meaning of freedom rather than their sloganistic meaning of freedom. So this rearticulation can work pretty easily, pretty effectively, if you can get people to engage in the kind of conversation where they can really examine their own beliefs. Now that's where the hot versus cold really comes in. The hot emotional connection with a particular articulation is what blocks that kind of reasoning. You know, it's why you can't have a conversation with some people when you think of them as a true believer, and when they get all riled up as soon as you start talking about it. The riled upness means that they have a lot of emotional investment in the way they connect these ideas. And that really is a barrier. You know, that's part of the defense. That's why nationalism and religion, when it's mobilized as an ideology in this way, why these ideologies are so dangerous and destructive is because they block the ability to really figure out how things are working. I think that's pretty good. I think we've got a good, and it's a nice, you know, this, I mean, it's not that I'm encouraging you to write any particular third paper. There's lots of interesting topics in this last block of the course. But it's a nice kind of, if you really go through it carefully, or did the equivalent thing for gender, which is another, or whatever. It's a good exercise. It's a really good way of deepening your own understanding of how these things work. And you also then have to establish, well, what's the vocabulary of articulating? So we've talked about a couple. There's a causal articulation. This element explains another. Or there's a moral articulation. The moral value of this comes from that. And you can think of other possible articulations. So you have to think about what does it mean to connect them, and then how do they connect. And then maybe, you know, you might find that there's a core. So I argued a little glibly that the core is private property constrains democracy, democracy constrains. And at that little couplet, then everything else is articulated to that couplet. But that's probably too simple-minded. I'm sure that there are separable connections between other elements. And a full bore exposition would sort that out for the contrasting matrices. All right. Let us, I think what we should do in respect to bodily needs and cobweb clearing, we should take a break and reconvene at 11:15. And we'll wrap up the hegemony pretty quickly, but then turn to legitimation and norms.